Okay, good afternoon. Today's date is April the 24th, and we are in New Orleans, Louisiana with Ms. Phyllis LeBlanc. April 24th, 2009. My name is Jamecia King.
Christina Resolus.
Alicia Bello.
Elizabeth Alexander.
Chanel Caldwell.
Shannon Palmore.
Phyllis Montana LeBlanc.
And we're from the class from the 2008-2009 sixth class.
All right, Ms. LeBlanc. What's your full name and your birth certificate?
My full name is Phyllis Montana LeBlanc. Date of birth?
Sure.
December 24th,
1963. And where did you get your name from?
My mom. Well, Phyllis is from, my dad's name is Philip. I was supposed to be a boy. Don't ask me why or how. They thought I was going to be a boy, so I got named Phyllis. Teresa from, we were raised Catholic in a Catholic religion. Teresa is the little flower that's very strong in spirit. Montana is my dad's last name. LeBlanc is my married last name. They're two great last names, so that's why I hyphenate Montana LeBlanc.
And were you the first child born?
Oh, no, I'm the middle child.
The middle child.
I'm the glue that holds everyone together no matter what they say, which is why I talk really fast. So sometimes you may just think, just slow down just a little bit. But that's why I talk fast. I'm a middle child. I have two older sisters, Gina, Catherine, Phyllis, Cheryl, Lisa, and I have a brother who we almost always forget because it was the five girls for so long. My mom had him in 1975. And his name is Thomas, and he is spoiled rotten.
Were you born in New Orleans?
Absolutely. Born in New Orleans, Louisiana at Charity Hospital, which was a hospital for people, poor people who didn't have insurance. It's been in New Orleans like forever, since Katrina. It's now been closed, and there's this big war about reopening it, blah, blah, blah. But I was born here in New Orleans.
So what was it like growing up in New Orleans?
It was fun. We did peewee baseball, everything was peewee. Baseball, softball, volleyball, track, football. I was quarterback. We had a lot of parks to play at. We grew up on what was called the bayou. If you ever hear about, we had bayous here, little small canals with, you know, the water flowing through. I caught my first bass there. But it was fun. We always had something to do. We got into trouble. We got into fights, neighborhood fights with girls who didn't like you because of whatever reason. Kind of like the same thing that's in today's day. If your hair's too long, or if your hair's too short, or if you have an absolutely wonderful, beautiful face like you do with a short haircut, with the earrings and stuff, got it going on, girl. And so it was always differences. But back then, I grew up in the 70s. When we had disagreements or arguments or fights on, like, say, the weekend, we would still go to school Monday and we'd be back friends. It was never as bad as it is now with shooting and killing and stuff like that. So it was a lot of fun. We ate the ice cream when the truck passed through the neighborhood. We sat on the porch. I think you all call them mediums, that thing that divides where cars pass on each side. We call them neutral grounds. And that's what it is. It's a neutral area. We used to actually play on that as well. But it was a lot of fun. On weekends, we ate boiled crawfish, boiled crab, seafood. We just hung out and had fun as kids.
What stands out most in your memory about in your childhood? When you think of your childhood growing up in New Orleans, what stands out?
My sisters. Because we didn't need anybody else. You know, like you said, you got to go find it. We had other friends, but with five girls and we're all right behind each other, my older sister is 47, Gina's 47, Catherine's 46, I'm 45, Cheryl's 43, Lisa's 42. Again, Thomas is in his 30s or something. We don't even remember. We don't remember how old he is. He's like 33 or something like that. So that was it. We always had something to do with the sisters. Rainy days, it was no problem that we couldn't go outside because we got to play with each other. when we played sports, we were almost always the team, and we were all good. I was a pitcher for baseball and softball, and my sister Catherine was the catcher, and I was really good. And so that's the thing that most sticks out, the closeness of the sisters. We always had each other then and today.
How has this New Orleans culture, how has it influenced your upbringing?
Hugely, because no matter where I go, I've visited, you know, places like D.C., Maryland, Florida, Texas. It's in a very, very good way because we have Southern hospitality. So when I went to Washington, D.C. for the first time, and I say was walking to the store and I saw somebody standing outside, and I said, good morning. And she was like, excuse me? And I said, okay, maybe I said it the wrong way. So I waited the next day and it was afternoon. And I said, good afternoon. So I said, okay, maybe that's not how everybody else does it. You know, the Southern hospitality thing or whatever, and just greetings and hoping and warning you to have a good day. So I said, well, just stop it. But the influence in my culture from New Orleans said, no, I'm going to teach these people how to say good morning, good evening, and good night. Good night is when you're going in for the night. It's nighttime or whatever. Good night. Hope you had a good day. And I kept saying it over and over and over again. And by the time I finished my complex, I was like, good morning, how you doing, Phyllis? Good evening, how you doing, Phyllis? So it's a huge influence. We love people. We love to cook for people. People from New Orleans, you know you've been here when you go back to where you come from. And then you start seeing, well, damn, you know, people don't act like in New Orleans. People say hello. People say hi. A long time ago during Mardi Gras, carnival time, you could walk to a parade and everybody's doors open anyway because the music is playing early in the morning for Mardi Gras. And you could walk into a complete stranger's house because they're cooking hot dogs, hamburgers, red beans, not gumbo because it's normally hot around that time. But you could just walk into anybody's house and just literally just eat. How you doing? Going to the parade and just eat. Child, get something to eat. Not C-H-I-L-D, C-H-I-L-E. No accent. Child, go on, get yourself here. Have fun. Be safe. Now don't run up with them boys. That's what we used to get told. But, of course, you ran up with the boys because that was the time to meet the boys. Unless you were with Uncle James. That's another story. Mm-hmm. He was the uncle that said, get away from my nieces. You can't talk to anybody. So that's huge, huge influence from the culture. Loving that you're black. You know, loving that. There's so many shades of us, dark skin, light skin, cafe au lait, which is the coffee with some hot milk in it, and just because we have everybody, whoever, all y'all colors in here now is in my family, and us brown ones, well, y'all, okay, y'all like my other sisters, my older sisters, let me see, Catherine and Gina, me is these. The dark browns, colors. That's how my family is. We had a family reunion one time. This is so crazy. And we had light brown, dark brown, really, really, really light-skinned, and really, really, really white-skinned. And they were all in separate areas. And so I asked my mom, I said, this is like a family reunion type thing. My Uncle Oliver was making his 100th birthday. And I said, these are like my cousins, right? And she was like, yes. I said, so why is everybody like separated? She said, that's just the way it's always been. So I said, I'm going to go around and say, hi, cousin. Because no matter if you're over here and you're really, really, really light skinned, we're still related. And so eventually I had everybody laughing and talking and blah, 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 because I'm the glue that holds everything together. But that's our culture. I mean, we're separated, but we somehow always come together. In the end, or in troubled times, or whatever, we're close. We're family. Everybody's family here.
Would you say that African American culture is distinct in New Orleans from the rest of the city?
Yeah, and it's so many different. Again, back to the flavors is what I call them. More so now, I think post Katrina, you see the heritage is getting more stronger now. People are getting back to it. Wanting to embrace it now. We're having people now not processing their hair, you know, hair anymore like I do mine, or frying it as they call it. And locking their hair. They're just doing what I call the African thing, getting back to the root of their the heritage. Again, my mom's what we call Creole, which is a light-skinned black person. She has very, very straight black hair. She's very, very light-skinned. We look like twins, which is different shades of skin color. And my baby sister, Lisa, started locking her hair. Lisa couldn't get a tan if you paid her to. That's how light her skin is. She lays in the sun and she gets really, really red, and then she gets brown, and then she takes a shower, and then she's back, you know, bright again. And she started getting the locks in her hair, and my mom said, "Why are you doing your hair that?" And then she said, "Because that's what I want to do with my hair. I want to lock my hair." And my mom says, "But that's not your actual hair." Because Lisa's hair is like my mom's, really, really straight. And her hair started locking, and my mom didn't like it. And so I had to take my mom to the side and talk to my mom and say, "Well, this is her African nature. This is her heritage." And I think we all need to dig deeper, because I hear some people saying, you know, my family wasn't, I don't have a history of slaves in my family. You know, nobody ever owned us and stuff like that. So you just have to do your own thing. But it's coming back stronger now. I'm seeing more of it, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful spirit. I love it. I embrace it. I haven't stopped crying yet, though.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about your Creole background?
Creole background. Oh, gosh. I can see on my mom's side, on my dad's side. More on my mom's side is Creole. And it's light-skinned black people. It's not a race. You know, some people say my grandfather used to say he wasn't black, he was Creole. I say, "Grandpa, we don't say grandfather, we don't say granddad, we say grandpa." It's G-R-A-W-P-A-W, grandpa. And grandma. And he said, "Look at those black folks." And I said, "Grandpa, you black." He said, "I am not black, damn it, I'm Creole." "Grandpa, Creole is not a race." But you couldn't tell him that. He's in his 80s. You can't tell him that where he grew up, that he knew he was black, but it was more of a, if you said you were Creole, you were a step above actually black people. You know what I'm saying? It's crazy, but it's, to me it's crazy, but it's how he grew up. Again, my mom's Creole. There's something that you call, that's called passon blanc, and it's passing for white. And there were a lot of Creole people back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s that were passing as white people so they didn't get a good education, get a good job. One of our, the first black mayor here, Mayor Dutch Morial, Mark Morial, who was also a mayor of our city, Dutch Morial came out and said he passed. And everybody got, a lot of people got mad with him, but he said, "The reason why I passed was so I can go to one of the top universities here in the city. I was able to go to law school, and here I am now, the first black, the first African-American mayor of the city of New Orleans." And so it's a lot of different things. They have some Creoles that, like my mom, will tell you, "Don't ever call her a passon blanc," because she has never passed. She said she used to ride in the back of the streetcar a long time ago. She said sometimes she would sit in the front. And I said, "Well, if you were sitting in the front, wouldn't that be passing?" And she said, "Well, no, I would be able to sit in the front if no other whites were taking up the seats." She said, "So if someone got on and they needed the seat, I had to get up and go to the black section." I said, "Colored people, you know, behind this line." But they can cook. Creole people can cook. They are the best cooks, I think, in the world, but we're going to stick with Louisiana. They are the absolute best cooks. I mean, once you eat Creole food, real Creole food from in somebody's home, a lot of great Creole restaurants like Dookie Chase's, where her daughter used to teach me, Miss Leah Chase, well, they had the same names. Miss Chase was my sister's third grade teacher at Phyllis Wheatley Elementary School. But Miss Chase, we used to always go to Dookie Chase's restaurant. We used to go to a little window, Creole cooking, and she used to make French fry po' boys. That was my first time eating them, and I've been hooked on them ever since. But the best food, stuffed shrimp, oh my God, I can talk about food forever. But that's a little bit, as much as I know about the Creole, they separated from, it was always skin color. You know, you had Creoles who separated from dark-skinned people, brown-skinned people. They had their own little area. That's why if you ever hear anybody say the Seventh Ward, or I can tell you from the Seventh Ward, if someone came in here and we just, from New Orleans, we just had a regular conversation, they say, oh, y'all from the Seventh Ward. Just because your skin colors are a couple of shades lighter than ours. We would be from the Ninth Ward, or the Eighth Ward, or the Seventh Ward, I mean, not the Eighth Ward or Ninth Ward, because that's where the darker-skinned people, or uptown people. Skin color. Crazy but true.
How would you put the difference between being Creole and being Cajun? What's the difference?
From my understanding, Cajuns are white people who were also connected with, just like Creoles, connected and blended bloodline with French people. So Cajuns are more white. I mean, authentically, as far as we know, white, because you never know who's got black blood in them and denying it or whatever, because from what they say, one drop makes you black.
I have a question. Considering that a lot of New Orleans culture is from French, like, when you're growing up in school, do you learn French first before Spanish, like everywhere else?
Actually, Latin we were learning, because we attended a school called St. Peter Claver, and they were teaching us Latin, and that was in the kindergarten and first grade. And we transferred to a public school after that, and forget about any kind of just straight up English, broken English, and how I talk now. But my mom, again, Latin. She was going to a Catholic school, all girls Catholic school, and they would teach them Latin. You had to say everything. You had to speak in Latin. And she's always telling this god awful story. And she's standing in the back of the choir, and she's mouthing the words. And the nun says, Rita, come to the front. Her name was Clovina Rita. And we need you to sing right now. She said, I would be so ashamed because I didn't know the words, because it was hard to learn Latin. And she finished there. I think she went there for, I think, like 7 or 8 years. I think she stopped going to school in eighth grade, so she couldn't help raise her sisters because she's the oldest. But no, not taught French. No, I learned a little bit. I think about the most that I know is Les Le Bon Temps Roule. What's that? Let the good time roll.
I have a question. You mentioned that your family weren't enslaved. They weren't slaves. Do you know any more about your family?
I think they were.
Oh, you think they were?
Yeah, right? I think they were. I've never done a family tree thing, but from what you get, bits and pieces of information about your family here, and because again, the gumbo—it's so many different bloodlines and heritage. But from what I understood, my dad was West Indies. Somewhere, his grandmother or his grandfather, is Blackfoot Indian. Is Blackfoot Indian, Native Indian, black for sure, French, I want to say Italian. It's ridiculous, you know. But I think my older sister was finding some slave history, but she never got to the ending of it, so I think so, though. I mean, because when I look at my dad, when I see his picture and the nose structure and the facial structure, bone structure, I think so, but my mom says no. But my mom's crazy. Nobody's owning her.
So how would you say growing up Catholic affected your upbringing? Was there any impact?
They were mean girls. I was so glad to get that public school. They really were. They were mean. Because again, those white students, not white students, it was very, very light-skinned black kids that I went to school with. And they were just mean. And Stacy, what's her name? I don't remember her. She used to pinch me all the time. And then we would get a chance to be hall monitor. Little bitty kids. And when I would get to be hall monitor, I would just make up all kind of stuff in a Catholic school. Just, you know, we got to go prayer class and everything. I would just lie just to get her in trouble, because that was the only way I can get her back. So I was taught how to get people back in the first grade. it's terrible, but it's true. But it was, I mean, again, it's always been racial. New Orleans is very, very racial, racially divided, racially conscious, racially ignorant. But for some reason, it was somehow, something bad happens, and we all become family for some reason, which is a good thing.
How long have you lived in New Orleans?
45 years. I left one time to live in D.C. That was in, I'm guessing, 1995. I moved to Laurel, Maryland, and then from Laurel, Maryland to Northwest D.C. Laurel, Maryland?
I'm from Bowie.
Oh, yeah. My roommate was from Bowie. I guess the university is Bowie University.
Yeah,
Bowie
State.
She went there.
Oh, wow.
She's going to Morgan State University now.
Baltimore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I loved it up there. I mean, we're educated, a lot of educated people here in New Orleans, but a lot not. So when I went up there, I got all of this flavor and these conversations from Howard University people, Bowie, and I forgot the name of this other place that they bragged about. But it was just that this education, and I'm like, wow, this one's saying I graduated from college, and I'm graduating from college, and here I am. I got bored in the 10th grade and said, I'm not going to school anymore because they're not teaching me anything. I'm not learning anything. My mom says, you're staying in. I said, I'm staying out. I won the argument. And I stayed out for a year. And this was at, like, I think I was 15, 16 years old. And I started hearing about this place called Urban League Street Academy is what they named it. And so I said, well, I'm going to go there and just get my GED. And when I walked into the school, they had all these black pictures of all these black people that had done all these wonderful things. The guy who did the Garrett, whatever, with the signal light, Garrett Morris. Is it? I think, not Garrett Morris, that was off Saturday Night Live. oh, my Lord. But I forget his name, but I'm just, and I'm like, I never want to leave, you know. And so I'm learning, like, so black people did do stuff, and so I was glad that I dropped out of school at that time, and I started embracing all of this black history, and I'm worthy now, and, you know, can do all of these things. And so that's why when I went to live in Maryland, and I got another taste of all of this education and young black people saying, I'm going to college, and I'm like, I'm meeting like you all. You know, you're my heroes. I'm going to talk about y'all forever because my sister Catherine, I talk to her every day. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to say, and I'm sitting here with these young women, and y'all are going to college, right? Y'all are in college, and y'all going to finish, right?
Yes, sir.
This is amazing. See? So this is like, okay, Brooklyn is going to have to get a sitter because I'm going to school. My husband, I'll just have to cook his meals, like, in advance, put them in a freezer and container, then he could just microwave, you know, for the rest of the week or whatever. But this inspires me. You all inspire me because I'm like, you know what? It ain't too late. And then I can stop saying ain't, which I do like saying ain't because it's a Southern thing. with the right way. But, yeah, that's I forgot what the question was. I start rambling.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Well, that's all it takes, though. We'll
Well, can you tell us about your experience through the different storms that occurred in New Orleans?
I take your question, or?
No. Well, I know we, of course, we want to hear your Hurricane Katrina story.
You don't have to if you don't want to, though.
but is it true that it floods a lot in New Orleans?
Yes.
So when there was an alert for New Orleans residents to evacuate during Hurricane Katrina, did a lot of people take that seriously, or was it just, okay, we flood all the time, so this is nothing new to us? How was the response to...
In the history of New Orleans, we are, I forget how many feet below sea level. In the history of New Orleans, we don't leave for hurricanes. The last major hurricane, I think I was 3 years old, was in 67, and I think that was Betsy or Camille, I forget which one it was. So that was in 67, all the way up to 2005, August 29th. We've never had a hurricane. They come here, we have hurricane season, which is June, and we just kind of get prepared, or if it's something, if it's going to be big, or if it's, we're going to leave, but we never leave because they come in the Gulf, and they go away. So when this came, it was like, same thing or whatever, just go down and get your food ready, flashlights, batteries, preparations. We just ride it out. That's our history. If you talk to anyone who's ever been, who's lived here all their lives in New Orleans, there are a group of people who say we never leave. There are a group of people who say every time the news people come on and say, you know, we have a threat of a hurricane, they automatically pack up and just leave somewhere like Baton Rouge or somewhere on the outskirts of New Orleans. But we've never left. And that has changed. I will never stay again for another hurricane. Never.
What ward was your apartment in?
They call it the Upper Ninth Ward. If you ask anybody in the city of New Orleans, we call it New Orleans East, the eastern part of New Orleans. But geographically on the map, I don't know who made those maps up, but they call it the Upper Ninth Ward. So in our area, we got like 5.5 feet of water. Just in that one area. So, but then you walk 2 blocks down and it was 10 feet of water. Mm-hmm. In the bowl. So where y'all came to pick me up at, we're actually at the top part of the bowl. So where we stayed at, if you went back behind my house, maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 5 blocks, it was like 7, 8, 9, 10. Some houses got 12 feet of water. And that was only 5 to 6 blocks away. But they were in the bowl because that's how they built the area.
So what were you doing when the hurricane actually struck? Or where were you?
We were in our apartment, 5 blocks, about a mile up where we drove up to, where we drove to go come here. And if you make a left 5 blocks down, so about a mile and a half away from where I live now, in an apartment on the second floor. We heard about the storm on Thursday, Friday. And it was like it was out there about what it was, you know, what category it was coming to be and which way it was going. And it always does that. It comes close to us and it goes off somewhere and just dissipates. And I told my husband, for some strange reason, something's not right this time. And it's like, oh, we're going to be okay or whatever. And you just get, you know, just getting the stuff together. Again, that's why I mentioned the ring. I found a little ring that I had before we first got married as little, and I was like, you bought me that in comparison. But anyway, love is blind. And so we were in the apartment complex when it hit. The normal thing, the book is going to drive you. If you haven't read the book yet, the book is going to be like, I wish I never read it, but I'm glad I did. But I balance y'all at the end. I show mercy at the end. We were in an apartment complex. My husband was like, I'm going to lay down and go sleep because he's got sleep apnea. So if he's sitting down for 5 minutes, he's sleeping. He wasn't medically diagnosed yet, but I had done my research and I knew he had it. Just had to get to the doctor. So we're in our apartment. Ryan and I, my mom and my sister and my nephew are in the apartment, in my mom's apartment across the way from us. And so we're talking on the cell phone. We're walking around and, you know, in the area and stuff, and I'm looking at the sky, and one of the things I say in the book is that my sister Catherine lost her husband, Michael, to liver cancer in 2004, and never drank, never smoked, nothing. Anyway, and he was 40 years old, very young, and Catherine, we were situated, and Catherine said, I forgot something at the house, because Ron and I had went to get her and Nicholas to come back to be in our area, by my mom, and she said, I forgot something, and I said, forgot what? because I didn't want to go back out because, I mean, it was starting to happen. No rain or nothing, but the sky was like, it's about to happen. So I told Ron, I said, Catherine wants to go back to the house. She forgot something. So we get in Catherine's truck and we drive back to the house. And she goes into the house, and then I feel bad afterwards because she comes out when Michael was, the cancer hadn't, he was in stage four. But he was still able to walk around, but in a lot of pain. But once he got bedridden, he made these flowers out of, I forgot that paper that we used to do assignments on in grade school or whatever, construction paper. And out of it, he made her a dozen flowers out of construction paper. And that's what she wanted to go back and get. And so we get this, and we go back, and we get to the apartment, we come, and then we get there, and we settle again. And she said she forgot something else. So I told Ron, you're coming with us this time. That way you sit in the truck, I'll go in with her. She wanted some more pictures of her husband. So we're coming back, and I told Ron, and I looked at the sky, and I said, shit is about to get serious. Because it was gray in one area, white in one area, and black in one area. And it was almost like they were waiting for that bell to ring to come together. And it reminded me of a really cute boy that you really, really like, and you know he's hot. But everybody is telling you, don't fool with him because he's bad. But you still want to fool with him anyway. And that's what it reminded me of. It's how nature can make you absolutely happy and give you the absolute most joy, but will kill you at the same time. And that's what it reminded me of. And I said, Ron, some serious shit is about to go down. I'm looking at these clouds. We need to get back. And it started raining. And by the time we got back to the apartment, the city was quiet. A lot of people had left. I said, all I need is a piece of tumbleweed to roll across the street now. We're going to be in serious trouble. Because it was that quiet. And I had never heard my city that quiet. It was empty. We knew people were there. I saw police and National Guardsmen and stuff. We get back to the apartment. We got everything ready. Everybody situated. Charge up the phones. The power is still on. I call Catherine, ask her what she's doing. She's watching BET. Why, I don't know. Music videos. I don't know who had come out with a new video at the time, but she said she was jamming to the... But she had it on for Nicholas because Nicholas loves music. His dad was a music major at Southern University in Baton Rouge. And so we just waited, and there's nothing worse. It's kind of like we're sitting in here right now, and the news has already told us that there's a Category 5 hurricane coming here, and the clothes that you have on your back, your purse, your pencils, your Mardi Gras beads, where you got them from, I don't know. This is all you have, your digital cameras and stuff like that, and this is all you have, and you're sitting here waiting for a Category 5 hurricane to hit the city. So while you're sitting here right now, it's kind of like, well, yeah, we know it's not going to happen. But if when you know it's happening, whoever you are individually will come out. Because I completely lost all sense of my intellectual faculties. I told my husband, I think I still have the shirt where you see kids holding on to the back of their dad's shirt or whatever. That pull or that print that's in. I think I still have that shirt because I dragged on that shirt. I said, Ron, just don't leave me, don't go anywhere. We're in the apartment. When it hit, he was sleeping, and I was crawling around on the floor trying to find somewhere in the closet with the pillow. I had a cubby hole there, nothing. I was like, okay, I'm sweating. I'm going to smother in here, just trying to run different places just to get comfortable until I had ran and crawled so much that I fell asleep on the cushion from the sofa, and that was a bad sofa, Italian leather, plum, gorgeous. This isn't one of those little regular pictures, but it was gorgeous, and that's where I fell asleep, and then the storm hit, because it was happening then, because we lost power, and that was like, it's for some reason, storms always hit when it's time for you to go to sleep. So it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, we finally fall, well, I was sleeping, we finally fall asleep, and then by 6, it's hitting, the outer bands of it, the eye hasn't come yet, and we're getting it, and then we start hearing water pouring somewhere, and I say, Ron, something, I'm totally frantic, I'm like, round up here, go over here, run here. And I'm screaming and yelling. I'm not talking nowhere near how low I'm talking now. And I'm just telling him to find out where the water is coming from because it's pouring somewhere. And when we finally turn around, it's pouring through a light fixture in our bedroom. We lost power. I was freaking out because I thought we were going to get electrocuted, but we didn't have any power. And Ron made me aware of that. He's like, well, the power's out. You can't get electrocuted. And I'm like, but what if there's some kind of surge somewhere? we got to get out of here. And I'm holding on to the back of his shirt. Ron is a quiet, quiet soul. He is an intelligent Winnie the Pooh. Very, very cushiony, very, very soft, very, very, if, you know, everything is okay, all right, we're going to be okay. But that was when we first met. He's much different now. He's got some of my spirit. But it was run for your life thing. It was, we got to do this, we got to do that, we got to get out of here, because once we saw heard the water coming in, and I ran to the front door and started noticing the water bubbles popping up all over the wall, and I asked Ron what it was, and Ron said, well, what do you mean, what is it? I said, there's water bubbles popping in the walls like measles or something. And then he said, you know what? He looked at him and he said, there's water coming through the walls. But how is the water coming through the walls if we're on the second floor and there's an apartment on top of us and one on the other side of the apartment that's next to us? We had to get out of the apartment to find, I mean, to look back and see that the two apartments over us, the rooftops came off and they were on top of our apartment, so all of the water was coming down into the walls and filling up in the floors. So our next drop was to the first floor with two rooftops on top of ours, our apartment, going down to the first floor. And that's all of those pictures that you see. We had to get out. I called my sister on the cell phone. I said, Catherine, we got to get out of here. Our apartment is about to drop. And she and I was getting ready to open the door. Well, I had Ryan in front of me. I was behind him. And I said, and she said, don't open the door. There's a 2x4 flying past the door in front of your front door. So I had to slam the door. Wait a minute. I said, Ron, when we go out, don't worry about me. When you start stepping, we're going down to his mother's apartment. They evacuated, so they were empty downstairs. Go down there just to get out of here. I said, don't look back. Don't worry about me because I'll be behind you. So we run out of there, run downstairs, get to my mother-in-law's apartment. We wait there for a while. At this time, no flooding. The storm is coming, and we were in the storm, but there's no water on the ground when we go into this downstairs apartment. By the time, I say within 30 minutes, that's when I started learning how to text. Because my sister said, and I'm like, how the hell do I write her back? And I'm every time, you know how you press, it's the JKL? Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to press whatever, and I couldn't get the thing to stick, the alphabet that I wanted to stick. And then I started, if I would let it go, it would stay. And I said, oh, okay, let me put the O, and then, you know, I'm trying to get love, and then the V, and then it was staying. I was like, okay, I'm out of there, and I was going to town. And I loved it. And then we were actually able to talk on the phone sometimes. She can call me, but I couldn't call her. And she was watching it on CNN in Los Angeles, and she said, Phyllis is 20 minutes away. And I'm like, all of this is going on, and they haven't even hit us yet. Like, hit us. And the phone call dropped, and she called me back again, and she said, Phyllis is 10 minutes away. And so I said, okay, we lost the phone signal again. And I said, honey, I said, whatever you've done that you need to repent for, now is the time. And I'm on my knees, and, you know, he's sitting in a chair, and I'm like, we need to pray. I was praying so fast. It sounded like I was speaking in tongues, but I wasn't, but I talk really fast. So if I'm really excited, it's Espanol. I mean, I'm like, I can understand what I'm saying, but nobody else can. And so I'm praying. I'm like, I'm getting myself prayed up, and I'm getting Ron prayed up, and I'm like, honey, is there anything you did that you need to ask God to forgive me for? And he's like, I said, even if you don't want to say it out loud, in your mind, say it, and then out of your mouth, say, God, forgive me. And apparently, it must have been something he didn't want me to know, because all I heard him say was, God, forgive me. So I let it go, because he had done his repentance, and I stopped for a moment and I said, you know what, Ron, something I never thought about. What if this is a time for us to die now? I had never thought about the moment that we never know how we're going to die. You hear parents saying, you know, we're not guaranteed tomorrow. You don't know how you're going to die. What if this is the time for us to die like this right now? I had never thought about that. And Ryan turned around and said, we're not going to die because I have a praying wife. And he said it in this big, loud, thunderous voice. And I stood up, or spiritually stood up, and I think I was telling y'all that yesterday when I heard the hooty hoo. And it was my sister Catherine calling me, and we got over there. It was basically, on a very small scale, if you go on a camping trip and things get rough, but just on a scale of a million, you know, higher, worse than that, because you don't know where you're going. You just know that you're in a really bad storm, and you just know that you're going to die. And then once the water starts to flood your area and it's not stopping, you know you're going to drown. Or even if you do know how to swim, knowing how to swim and mentally in a situation of survival, you kind of forget how to swim. You know, it's like, I know how to swim, but how do I swim if I'm hearing glass breaking, rooftops crashing, people screaming, somebody's child fell in the water, and somebody has a radio, and you're hearing 911 operators say, 911, can I help you? Knowing that they can't help you. And the lady's in the attic, and she's saying, I'm in my attic, and the water's up to my neck. In the attic. And I have my two-month-old daughter. And I can't break a hole through my rooftop. And the operator's saying, I'm sorry, ma'am, but we're not sending out any rescue. There's not going to be any rescue, ma'am, until after the storm has passed. And the lady's on the phone saying, so I'm going to die. Me and my baby are going to die. And the 911 operator saying, ma'am, I'm sorry. All she can say is the same thing over and over. And the lady says, well, since no one's coming to get us, she lays her baby in the water and drowns her baby. And while the line is open, she lays herself in the water and she drowns herself. So, what was the question again? That's how bad it was. And when I read that story, I was in a grocery store. I was reading that story when we were staying out on the outskirts of New Orleans. And I remember reading it in front of me, but everything around me was black. Nobody was there with me. It just, when I read that story, I was just in the story. That's why I had to write this book. If I wouldn't have written this book, I probably would have died. Because it helped me to get everything out. Spike Lee started it for me. Spike Lee helped me to tell my story and when the levees broke. And then after we finished that, like, Phyllis, you should write a story. I didn't know you know how to write poetry. And I said, because I wrote this, you know, poem last night before we finished filming. I just wanted to see if you like it. And I gave it to him, and he said, read it. I said, but you didn't even read the poem. Read it. And I was like, okay. Got ready to film, and I read the poem. And he said that poem, which is called Not Just the Levees Broke, summed up his entire documentary, his four-hour documentary. Now, if y'all want to hear it, I can read it for you.
Yes.
And this is what I do. Whenever I go places, whenever I speak, this is his Mac Daddy days. This is Nicholas. They're still getting testing because he wasn't autistic when he was born. He wasn't autistic when he was one, when he was two, when he was three. Whatever age it is that you get to when they give you the shots, the set of shots that babies get, something to do with mercury. And I think at 3 years old, he stopped talking, stopped everything. He's autistic now. He's just not learning how to talk at 12 years old. But it's amazing. And he is, once you meet him, you love him because he's such a sweet potato. He's spoiled rotten. The reason why, this lady asked me one time, I wrote this book myself while I was in a FEMA trailer. And this lady asked me one time, I said, I've never sat down and read my own book. What I meant by that was, I've never sat down and read it like you would read it. You know, you go to the store, you buy a book, and you say, I'm going to sit down and read this book. I read the book when I was writing it. I don't want to be the customer to read this book all over again because I lived it. I started reading it a couple of days ago sometime, but I have other stuff I'd rather read because this takes me all the way back, and I don't want to go back to that. The name of the poem is not just the levees broke. They wrote it wrong here though. Not just the levees broke, the spirit broke, my spirit. The families broke apart. I want my mama, my sister, my nephew back home. The auction block broke from so many African American bodies. The sense of direction was broken because of the darkness. There was light from time to time, but they broke away and left us. My being together broke when I fell apart. The smell broke away from my skin when I came out of the waters. The waters that came and stood still with the bodies of my people, the dogs, shit and piss, rats, snakes, and herd of alligators. The broken smiles, the broken minds, the broken lives. And you know something? You want to know something? Out of all of this brokenness, I have begun to mend. With God, my deep, deep commitment to infinite strength and to never give up, I am mending. I am coming back. God willing for a long, long time. So when you see the waters, when you see the levees breaking, know what they really broke along with them. And that basically sums it up. Because we survived Hurricane Katrina. Because if I can tell you that we walked through the water, we waded through the water, we got out of the complex, we used refrigerators, the helicopter came, left us. We survived the storm. It was the Corps of Engineers' neglect to fix the levees from 40 years ago. When I was 3 years old, when I told you about in 67, they were supposed to fix the levees then. I don't know anything about dynamiting them. If I don't have the proof, I can't say it. I wouldn't put it past the government. And especially after the way George Bush treated us. And that's the reason why I say if it had been predominantly white people there, I think the response to help us would have been quicker. But I saw with my own eyes all black people. Every last one of them, I mean, I've seen 3, 4, 5 white people, but black babies, dark skinned babies with rosy red cheeks, that's some severe dehydration for a child for that skin color to have cherry red cheeks, and the lady screaming, my baby is dying, and so I told my husband, Ryan, we're next in line to get on a helicopter, but please, let's just let them go. I'm so exhausted, I just want to lay down and die. I was just that tired. To the point where when a guy came out and said, it's going to be no more rescue attempts, we have to walk 5 miles to get to the next pickup point in pitch black darkness with an entire lake on one side of us and on the other side of us, I think maybe 6 to 8 feet of water in pitch black darkness. And that's what we had to do. And that's why I said I felt like Harriet Tubman on the Underground Railroad, because people had lanterns. And this was in 2005. That we were treated like slaves, we were treated like animals, we were treated like niggers. And I was so angry, I probably could have killed somebody. You know what I'm saying? And because you're in that animalistic way, you're being treated like an animal, so you have to survive. But I believe in God, and that's why I'm here. And that's why I wrote the book, and that's why a whole lot of things are going on with me. And I love my city. New Orleans is not going to just go away. I mean, eventually, because we're below sea level, they're just going to wipe us away anyway. But that's like way down the line. So when you hear people saying, you know, New Orleans is going to be going anyway, they're talking 100 years. I'm 45. So, do I have any more questions?
Where do you see New Orleans 20 years from now?
If it goes according to a certain group of people who are thinking commercially, who are thinking touristy, if they have their way, riverboat casinos, boardwalks, ports, for, you know, the ships coming in and out or whatever. I think that a lot of the homes that people have grown up in all their lives, my mom is still bothered that she has to visit a city that she's been living in for 70-something years. If they have their way, if I have my way, and if the people that want it to still stay with the culture, the African-American culture, the Indian, the French, the whole nine yards, it could still be both. It really could. If we blended it, if we worked together with it, but greed for money and power somehow almost always wins. But I think if we're motivated enough, and I'm a motivated person, and we get some movement started, I think we could still keep the homes here, build it to be a better New Orleans, because New Orleans was injured before Katrina. It's even worse now with the black-on-black crime, homelessness, price gouging for the apartments are now double and triple. Health care, we have our governor, Bobby Jindal, rejecting stimulus money for health care and education and unemployment. So, I don't know. I'm hopeful of the things that I just said, but from what people are trying to do, it's more or less trying to make it a tourist attraction, where this is a family type environment. I mean, great grandma, great grandpa, I mean, cousins, family, this is a family city. But some people have different agendas.
Well, before we conclude, is there anything that you'd really like to tell us, any last thoughts, anything you want to share with us?
Buy the book. I am, of all people, and there's a lot of other people just like me, that are very, very hopeful, but we don't use hope as a plan. My point is that I have to actually participate in the growth, in the recovery of New Orleans. I can't just talk about it. I have to be about it. I can't just talk the talk. I have to walk the walk. So I hope that everybody also that has Katrina fatigue, you know, it happened 4 years ago, all those folks should be done by now. Wake up. Don't have Katrina fatigue. We still are in need here, and we still are recovering, and we need every kind of help that you can get. So spread the word. We're still here. You can still come and visit here, but lend a helping hand. And I just, y'all my girls. Y'all have inspired me.
And lastly, what current projects are you working on?
Right now, I'm working on an HBO TV series with David Simon, who did The Wire. I'll be playing Wendell Pierce's living girlfriend. I'm working on my second memoir called No More Wire Hangers, and that's to do with teenage domestic abuse that I went through as a teenager. So I can kind of help young people to say, if a boy hits you, knock him out. But advise somebody, don't let anybody put their hands on you, because we're beautiful black women and we need to grow old and have children and make this a stronger race. Piles of people.
Okay.
You got them?
There's a woman who at one of the maids on campus who wants to meet you. If you'll do just 10 minutes with her,